Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover Bookstore on Colfax Avenue. Thank you so much for coming out this evening. We really appreciate you supporting our independent bookstore and also all our author events. I'm really excited tonight to be able to introduce Nathaniel Philbrick, who is a multi-award-winning author. I was looking at the list and I thought, I can't go through all these or I'll be talking all night. But his new book, Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution, is already on the New York Times bestseller list in the top 10, and I know it will be for a very long time. It follows an amazing array of work, including The Heart of the Sea, which won the National Book Award, Revenge of the Whale, Sea of Glory, which won the Theodore and Franklin D. Roosevelt Naval History Prize and other prizes, and The Mayflower, which was the finalist for both the Pulitzer Prize and the Los Angeles Times Book Award, and it won the Massachusetts Award for Nonfiction. The Last Stand, which was named the 2010 Montana Book Honor Award and the 2011 ALA Notable Book, and Why Read Moby Dick. And he also has two of these that are sort of geared toward young adult, from The Mayflower and the whale book. So Revenge of the Whale book. So they're back there as well. But anyway, he's an amazing author, and I want to give him all the time tonight. So please welcome Nathaniel Philbrick.
Well, thank you. I always look forward to coming to Denver, and particularly to the Tattered Cover, one of the great bookstores anywhere. And I had a really good Sunday afternoon. I went to see the Rockies. And this great game. Great game. That is a great stadium, too. Oh, man. But it is great to be here to talk about a book that has been gestating in my mind since fifth grade, when I read the book that changed my attitude towards history, Johnny Tremaine. God bless Esther Forbes. I mean, this little novel, for me, was the first time where I began to realize that history is not just dates and statues and giant figures looming over the us pitiful people in the present. History was enacted by people like us. And there was Johnny, a kid like, you know, an ordinary kid caught up in extraordinary circumstances. And that book really caught my attention. And then in 1984, many years later, moved to the Boston, to the North End, the most historic of neighborhoods in Boston. And I was a sailing journalist at that time, but my primary responsibility was our 18-month-old daughter. And I spent many an afternoon pushing the stroller through the crooked streets of the North End, the Copp's Hill Graveyard. If you've been to Boston, it's one of the great spots. It's the high point of the North End with wonderfully old, crooked gravestones around. There's one that has the dents left by musket balls when the British regulars used it for target practice because it was the grave of a noted patriot. And for me, this was when I began to think, well, so what was it like in the time of Johnny Tremaine? And my wife and I began a weekend routine where Sundays I would take the subway, known as the T in Boston, to the Boston Public Library and begin to research the history of Boston. And so I got into it when we were in Boston in 1984, moved to Nantucket, and transferred my new interest in history to the history of that place, and wrote Away Offshore, my first work of history, and then In the Heart of the Sea, and went on from there. And each book has evolved organically. And it was after Mayflower, which begins with that famous voyage, but ends 55 years later with the terrible Native English conflict known as King Philip's War. It was, which ended in 1676. And I realized, well, with the end of that, I wonder what happens 100 years later. And I began to realize, wait, there's a lot of unfinished business in the 17th century that informed what would happen 100 years later. I think there's a tendency to look at the Revolution as this burst of something brand new and different, when in reality, I began to realize how essentially conservative it began. Independence was not a part of the conversation. Even the most radical patriots, Samuel Adams and other patriot leaders, were not talking independence. They were talking about having Massachusetts have a direct say in how its representation when it came to what was going on in Parliament. And this was nothing new. The Puritans had arrived in Boston in 1630, looking to be beyond the reach of the king and his bishops. And in 1676, in the midst of King Philip's War, the Governor Leverett of Massachusetts said to a British agent, our legislative body, the General Court, has precedence over anything Parliament can tell us, and if the king wants to give us more liberty, that would be fine. And this agent was absolutely outraged, but it was exactly what would be saying 100 years later. Now, I'd like to end my remarks tonight by reading a passage from my book. It's actually the last portion of the book. Hopefully this will not be give away the plot too much. But it begins after the evacuation of the British. With the approach of the summer of 1776, Bostonians began to emerge from the dark doldrums of the siege. By this time, after after the evacuation, all those patriots who had been out in the surrounding towns began to flood back into the city. In fact, it was decimated by the British occupation. Howe's fleet of almost 150 vessels, full of loyalists and primarily British soldiers, had sailed for Halifax at the end of March, but a few naval warships continued to linger near the Boston Lighthouse to warn supply ships arriving from Britain that the army had removed to Nova Scotia. On June 13, the last of the men of war was finally forced to depart when cannons were installed on one of the harbor's outlying islands. By the middle of July, word had reached the city of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. They were no longer fighting simply to preserve their ancient liberties. They were fighting to create a new nation. The officers of Washington's army had begun to talk in these terms as early as the fall of 1775, but not until the publication of Thomas Paine's Common Sense in January 1776 did the goal of independence begin to look like an inevitability. "We have it in our power to begin the world over again," Paine wrote. "A situation similar to the present hath not happened since the days of Noah until now. The birthday of a new world is at hand." On July 18, the Declaration of Independence was made public for the first time in Boston. As sheriff, William Greenleaf was supposed to read all official proclamations, but the 56-year-old Greenleaf had a weak voice, so he asked Thomas Crafts, the same man who had objected to the promotion of Henry Knox to colonel of the Army's Artillery Regiment, to act as his herald. A big man with a fiery red face, Crafts was now a colonel in the Massachusetts Artillery Regiment, and he and Greenleaf stood together on the balcony of the townhouse. Ahead of them was not only a large, and the townhouse exists today, it's known as the Old State House. Ahead of them was not only a large crowd, but an unobstructed view of Long Wharf, where more than 2 years before, General Gage and his regulars had first disembarked. Greenleaf read a passage from the Declaration. Crafts repeated the words in his own booming voice, and so it went. According to Abigail Adams, who was in the crowd that day, great attention was given to every word. As soon as Crafts had finished, the cry from the balcony was, Abigail wrote, "God save our American states!" And then three cheers, which rended the air. The bells rang. Privateers fired. The forts and batteries. The cannon were discharged. The platoons followed. And every face appeared joyful. Later that evening, the ornate figures of the lion and the unicorn, representing England and Scotland, that bracketed the gable at the front of what Adams now called the State House, was taken down and burned in a bonfire, along with the king's arms from the courthouse. Boston had survived, but every vestige of the king was destroyed that night. "Thus ends royal authority," Abigail wrote, "and all the people shall say, Amen." Thank you very much. Any questions? Yes. Yeah, the question is my process. You know, it's really fun to go on book tour because it's really boring most of the time. I'm working on these books. Actually, I love it. But each book takes about 3 years. The first year is a broad net is thrown out. I'm creating my bibliography, collecting the books, reading, creating a sense of the arc of the story, a rough sense of the chapters. And then I begin to write the first chapter after about a year of this. And that requires me to research all over again. I realize the holes I have and what I need to know. I have a research assistant based in the D.C. area. So he can get to the Library of Congress and places like that very easily. And often it becomes, for me, each chapter is it sort of has its own deadline. I'm a journalist by training, and I get so into these books that it becomes a 7-day-a-week, sometimes 10-hour-a-day process of reading, note-taking. Each chapter can have 150 pages of typed notes that require me then to take notes on the notes. And which I'm basically trying to have all of that material in my head. And then after 3 weeks to a month of this process, I'm ready to write. And the writing process takes about a week. And then I have a first draft, which I then read to my wife after dinner while she's doing the dishes. She has a little notepad beside her. And whenever there's something that she doesn't agree with or has an issue with, she writes on it. And so I go, what was wrong? What? She just keep going. So anyway, so I go through that. And then for me, it is really important to read it. It's suddenly a whole different perspective on the manuscript. It's things that seem fine on the computer screen suddenly just don't work when I'm reading it orally. And so it's an important process in both ways. She's tough. And then my parents, who are both alive, my father's retired English professor, read the manuscript. My dad's tough, but my mom, ooh. And my research assistant reads it. And then I get it to a point where I think it's about there. And then I go on to the next chapter. And then it goes to finally I'm done. And then it's a half 6 months more of reworking that manuscript. And I think that's when the good stuff happens. So often, I think the best details, the best anecdotes emerge in the very late innings of my process. Yes?
I'll get you.
The question is, how do current events influence my process? I think we all try, as writing about history, to channel the past, but no one succeeds in doing it uninfluenced by their surroundings. Edward Gibbon's History and Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire was written during the American Revolution. And it's as much about the English Empire as it is about Rome. And if you look at the history written by professional historians in the 60s and 70s, Vietnam is all over that. And I think, you'd be kidding yourself to say you're able to write in a vacuum. It's just not the case. And, it's funny. When I'm in the middle of a book, I work from the primary sources to the point that when I'm in that chapter-by-chapter process, I'm so into it, I really lose the ability to know where it's going. And, I guess I'm kidding myself to a certain extent, but it's really trying to engage at that point. And so, I am not consciously drawn. I'm not saying, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. It's only really after I have a manuscript done and I'm working on the epilogue that I begin to go, whoa, boy, the Boston Committee correspondence sounds a lot like, the internet in Arab Spring. you know, I'm not consciously seeing that even when I'm working on it. After the fact, when I begin, when readers begin to say to me, hey, you know, these parallels, often I'm the last person to figure that out. But definitely, you know, that's why every generation has to rewrite history, because we find different things every time we look. I mean, it's a whole different perspective, and you can't do the simplistic thing and say, you know, everyone has an agenda in the present, and it's very dangerous to look to the past to support your agenda. Because the past was a different time. It was totally different. You can't, you know, it doesn't work that way. So I'm very leery to do that. Because they did this, we should do that. You know, they didn't know what was happening. No one saw independence going on. It was, no one had this blueprint drawn up. And we are here today. We're all in a world where who knows where we're directed. I mean, that's just the way it is living in the present. Yes.
You mentioned militias. You mentioned a different time, the 1700s. How does that relate to the way? What was the Second Amendment?
Second Amendment. Right to bear arms, yes. Well, you know, it's interesting. Clearly, the experience of the Revolution informed the Founding Fathers. They couldn't have pulled it off. One of the reviewers of my book said, the next revolution will not be tweeted. You know, you need to have an army. And it was because there was the militia that you know, it happened. And the forefathers realized we wouldn't be who we were without that. That said, their notion of liberty was different from what has evolved in America today. You know, we think of personal liberty. They were thinking of a collective liberty. These were militia to defend their communities. Needless to say, they were using a very different technology from what we have available today. So, you know, it's just, once again, it's different times. I mean, so I am very leery about drawing lessons from the past. The past was different. Different circumstances, different technologies. The right to bear arms was important for them for a very different set of social and historical circumstances than we have today. And yet, you know, that is part of our heritage, you know, and so you can't deny that. And so, you know, that's kind of where I look at it. Yes. Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, I wouldn't describe it necessarily that way. I mean, what happened was there was the East India Company, which, you know, was a monopoly. Let's call it Starbucks, that sold tea at a pretty high price. And as a consequence, smugglers, including many Patriot merchants, smuggled cheap illegal Dutch tea from the Caribbean at a third less the price. And that's how they did very well by it. The Tea Act actually reduced the price of tea by a third, undercut the smugglers, so that many of these merchants now couldn't make money off of it. There was a small 3 pence tax in there, which was really a symbolic thing rather than an onerous. This was actually a windfall for the colonial consumer. So the Patriots, many of them, were looking for ideological reasons to oppose it, while many of their pocketbooks gave them reasons to oppose it. It's like anything. It's not just one reason why things happen. There's all sort. It's a maze of things happening, and so that all contributed to it. So, I mean, the irony is, the American colonies were the least taxed, most well-off people in the British Empire at this time. The British government had just fought the French and Indian War, which ended in 1763, largely on New England's behalf, and as a consequence, we're now more than $22 billion in debt. And so they were saying, wait a minute, if we're going to go into the future in any way, we have to figure out how our colonies are going to contribute to their upkeep. And everyone in the colony said, sure, we understand that, but we want to determine how we do it. And there was the rub. Yes?
Interesting on the Dorchester Heights cannon. A little what if. They had the cannon, but they didn't have enough powder and shot. What if the British knew that?
Yeah, you raise a very good point that, you know, you get the cannons at Dorchester Heights, but they didn't have enough gunpowder. And that was almost, it was such a test for Washington, because here he had them surrounded. He wanted to attack. You know, he didn't favor the Dorchester Heights maneuver. He actually wanted to go in there and set Boston aflame and get the British Army while they had them. The problem is he didn't have enough gunpowder, and his Council of War, composed of about a half dozen generals, of which the Continental Congress insisted that Washington get their okay before he do anything like this, kept saying, no, we're not going to do that. And so thank goodness it would have destroyed Boston and perhaps the Continental Army. This was Washington. Washington was learning, and that's the great thing about Washington. You can watch him learn and build from his experience. So many people can't do that, you know, when it comes to leaders. They're just one kind of leader, and they can't adapt. Washington was different. And yes, there was very little gunpowder. Washington was not apprised of how small amount of gunpowder until after more than a month after he was there. And it was shocking. And so he created a navy, what would become a navy, in part to try to use privateers and other vessels to waylay British supplies of gunpowder coming to the British troops. And he was somewhat successful in that. And yes, it was a show of force rather than an actual possession of force. One other irony, after the Battle of Bunker Hill, as soon as word got back to England in July, the British government says, whoa, this is a war. We now have to deliver a knockout punch to the colonies and stop this before it continues. Boston isn't the place to do it. This is a terrible place. It's too isolated. We need to mount an invasion force to the south. So they decided as early as July, the British ministry decided to evacuate Boston. Word did not get to Howe, who had replaced Gage as head of the army, that he should evacuate. When he learned of it that fall, he said, I don't have enough ships. We're going to have to wait until the spring. And so the great irony is the biggest threat to Boston was not from the British. They were going to go. Anyways, it was from George Washington, who had no way of knowing that and wanted to attack. Okay, yes. Women played a big role. And you know who is the most eloquent person in all of this is Abigail Adams, who I quote here. And, you know, she makes the wonderful point to her husband, John, you know, in the ramp up to the Declaration of Independence, right around the time of the siege, where, you know, she says two things that are very interesting. She says, I love this guy, George Washington. But can someone who owns slaves have the same sense of liberty as, you know, can they? And then the other thing, John, is while you're looking at all this, what about, don't forget the women. She said, men are naturally tyrannical. Some things never change. And that, you know, it's, you know, there's an inequality there. There are strong women throughout my book. Joseph Warren had a fiance at the time he died, who was tending to his children in Worcester during all of this, named Mercy Scully. She was the daughter of John Scully, who was the head of the Boston Selectmen during the siege. And she just writes these wonderful letters, very eloquent letters. When Joseph Warren dies, she's knocked for a loop. And she also was a poet. And so she was very interesting. And then the wives of the generals, Henry Knox's wife was a real pistol, and Thomas Gage's wife was American born, and there's a tradition that she may have informed Joseph Warren that the British were headed, the regulars were headed for Concord. I discussed that. It probably didn't happen, but this is a story in which everyone's involved, and particularly when it comes to the militia, you begin to see that while the militia were out there fighting, they needed a support system, and they were very integrated in terms of keeping the colony together, even as the place was turned inside out by revolution. Thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.